From the studios of WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn, inviting you to meet our guests and be part of the discussion. On today's Coastline, we're asking, how will tax reform affect you? There's been considerable discussion around the state over whether tax reform is needed. The current system is the same one that's been in place since the 1930s, and the state's economy has changed dramatically since then. Most notably, North Carolina has evolved from an agricultural and manufacturing-based economy to one largely driven by services. There have been multiple efforts over the last several decades to reform the system, but so far they've all failed. So what is the best approach to tax reform? There are several organizations with proposals out there while the General Assembly works to draft legislation. What are some of the ideas under consideration, and what could the implications be for all of us? Here to help us explore these questions, Alan Fryer, public policy analyst at the North Carolina Justice Center. Alan joined the North Carolina Budget and Tax Center, which is a project of the Justice Center, almost 2 years ago with a focus on economic analysis. He's served as policy advisor to three members of the U.S. Congress and as an independent economic development consultant to nonprofits, universities, and state and local government agencies. The North Carolina Justice Center describes itself as a nonpartisan research and advocacy organization dedicated to transforming North Carolina's prosperity into opportunity for all. Alan, welcome to Coastline.
Thanks. It's great to be here with you, Rachel.
Joining us by phone today is Dr. Roy Cordato. Dr. Cordato is vice president of research and a resident scholar at the John Locke Foundation. He's taught at Campbell and Auburn Universities, the University of Hartford, and he's been a member of the adjunct faculty at Johns Hopkins. In addition to publication in economics journals and law reviews, his articles have appeared in the Christian Science Monitor, the Washington Times, and Investors Business Daily. He's been at the John Locke Foundation, a libertarian think tank, for more than a decade. Dr. Cordato, welcome to Coastline.
Glad to be here, Rachel.
During the next hour, we invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments about tax reform and how it might impact the local economy and your family. Give us a call at 910-343-1138 or send an email to talk@whqr.org. You can also tweet us at #HQRTalk. Now, let's start with the current system and why it needs to change. Dr. Roy Cordato, you contend that the current tax system violates most of the sound principles of taxation and good economics. You say it penalizes savings, investment, even entrepreneurship. How does it do that?
It does it in several different ways. First of all, income taxes in general, double tax saving and investment of all kinds. A pretty well-known principle of public finance. It does that by when you tax a dollar of income, you reduce both the returns to consumption and the returns to savings. But then when you tax the returns to those savings, interest, dividends, and so on, you are reducing those savings again. So, for example, in North Carolina, while we have a 7.75% top rate on income, in general, on interest income, it amounts to about double that, over 15% in reality. So that's one way that that happens. Another is through several taxes we have, the corporate income tax, which has a lot of problems, almost the least of which is that it adds another layer of taxation on saving and investment, and the estate tax, which is basically taxing income that's already been taxed.
Right. And we're going to get into the details of specifically why you're so opposed to having a corporate income tax at all. Mm-hmm. Alan Fryer of the North Carolina Tax and Budget Center, your organization describes itself as nonpartisan, but just tell us a little bit about your organization's mission and how that shapes your tax reform proposal.
Certainly, Rachel. Again, it's great to be here with you and the other guests. The The Budget and Tax Center is a project of the broader North Carolina Justice Center, and we are a policy advocacy organization that advocates and conducts research on behalf of low and middle income residents of North Carolina. We're particularly interested in making sure that the economic competitiveness and the prosperity that Dr. Cordato spoke about is as widely shared as possible in the state's economy.
Dr. Roy Cordato of the John Locke Foundation, before we get into the real nitty-gritty of John Locke Foundation's proposal, what does your proposal essentially seek to accomplish? What are the philosophical underpinnings of it?
Well, there's several. First of all, from an economics perspective, myself being an economist, I want to see an efficient tax system. And what I mean by that is, in economics, we basically look for neutrality in a tax system. We don't want a tax system that penalizes some activities relative to others, that leaves people essentially allocating their income the way they would in the absence of the tax. And so we seek to eliminate biases of all kinds from the tax system. A second principle is transparency. We think that that people who pay taxes should know that they're paying them, should be clear to them what they are paying, and how much their government is costing them. And we think that for a free and open democratic society, that is what we should seek. And also, we take the Section 1. Article 1, Section 1 of the North Carolina Constitution seriously, which says that all people have a right to life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, and the fruits of their labor, which is interesting because that's a different than the Declaration of Independence. And so it is an issue of fairness for us that people, as it is apparently in the North Carolina Constitution, that people have the right to keep as much of the fruits of their labor as possible.
So, Dr. Cordato, one of the assertions that you're making is that the current system of taxation actually changes people's behavior and changes the behavior of businesses. Is that right?
Not just business. It changes people's behavior in lots of ways. The one way I pointed out to you was with respect to savings and consumption. Penalizes savings relative to consumption, but it through lots of other taxes, cigarette taxes, alcohol taxes, and so on, it seeks to alter people's behavior in lots of different ways.
Alan Fryer of the North Carolina Tax and Budget Center, can you give us sort of a general overview of what your reform proposal involves?
Absolutely, and I think Dr. Cordato did a good job of summarizing some of the reasons why we need to ensure that we reform our outdated tax system. I think it's first important before sort of getting into the technical aspects or even the philosophical aspects to understand what the goal of state taxation is. The goal of state taxation is to raise enough revenue to be able to finance state government activities. So the first pillar of what we think needs to go into a tax reform proposal is adequacy, ensuring that the state is able to raise enough revenue to finance core public investments, many of which also have a significant contribution to the economic growth that we were talking about before, notably public education, job training, infrastructure, some of the core public investments that really do influence how firms behave, sometimes in greater, more influential ways than the tax code does. Secondly, I really appreciated that Dr. Cordato mentioned the fairness issue and how the state constitution really does enshrine this idea of fairness. And we believe fundamentally that the state, that any tax reform needs to embody principles of equity, that we don't ask lowest income people to pay a greater share of their income than they do now. We believe in a progressive approach to taxation that does require those who are better off to pay a greater share of their income. And it's important to recognize that the current system doesn't actually do that, despite some of the penalties that Dr. Cordato mentioned in terms of investment and what have you, that actually in the current system, low-income folks actually pay a greater percentage of their income in various state and local taxes than do high-income folks. So in a lot of ways, the state tax code as it currently exists is upside down. And so we believe that any reform package should make sure that we're able to turn it right side up again.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Coastline. The phone lines are open. We're talking about tax reform at the state level and what it might mean for you. If you have an idea about how state legislators should approach tax reform, if you have ideas, concerns, comments, we'd like to hear from you. Give us a call at 910-343-1138 or send an email to talk@whqr.org. You can also tweet us at #HQRTalk. And Alan Fryer of the North Carolina Tax and Budget Center. We're going to get into some of the specific needs of this coastal area because the economy here is a little different from other parts of the state. But in sort of a general way, how do you see this area as different from the rest of the state?
Absolutely. I love Wilmington. It's great to be here. Obviously, being on the coast, tourism is an important part of the Wilmington economy, and that has only increased over the last 10 years as the state as a whole and then the region in particular has experienced a lot of transition away from manufacturing, the traditional manufacturing base that supported low and middle income folks across the state.
Coming up next, we'll take a closer look at the proposals for tax reform that are on the table and how those ideas might impact this area. To help us explore that, New Hanover County Manager Chris Coudray will be joining us in the studio. The phone lines are open. What do you think about tax reform? Give us a call, 910-343-1138, or send an email to talk@whqr.org. You can also tweet us at #HQRTalk. Your calls and emails coming up after the break. You're listening to Coastline. Welcome back to Coastline. We're talking with Alan Fryer of the North Carolina Justice Center and Dr. Roy Cordato of the John Locke Foundation. Also joining us in the studio now is New Hanover County Manager Chris Coudray. Before becoming county manager in July of last year, Chris served as assistant county manager for 4 years. A large part of his mandate is to develop the county's annual $262 million budget, which serves more than 210,000 residents. Welcome to Coastline, Chris.
Well, thank you for having me.
Great to have you here. We're talking today about tax reform at the state level. Chris Coudray, as county manager, you've observed that New Hanover County's economy is on a par with Wake, perhaps even Mecklenburg County in terms of property tax value, but not when it comes to per capita income. Can you explain that?
Well, I think when you look at the value of our base for the size community that we are, 199 square land miles, 210,000 people, we've got a $29 billion tax base, which seems rather sustainable and quite large compared to other communities of our size. And I think that's an accurate statement. But when you think about per capita income, household income, our community lags behind, obviously, places like Wake, Mecklenburg. So we are in the bottom tier of the MSAs, or metropolitan statistical areas, in North Carolina. So the tax base is not necessarily reflective of the capacity of the families that are here to pay.
And what is that going to mean for tax reform at the state level? What are you concerned about from where you sit?
Well, I'm first of all concerned and would like to make sure that the General Assembly considers the importance of local government, particularly county governments, and the role that it plays in providing public service. And irrespective of what the state does on tax reform, it's inconceivable that there's not a plan that ultimately impacts either all counties or all counties and all municipalities. There will be some impact, I believe, on the revenue side for local government. And we need to be concerned about that. The General Assembly needs to be aware of that and make sure that our base, our ability to raise revenue to provide public service, is not eroded.
Now let's explore some of the main ideas behind the two tax reform proposals that we're talking about here today. We're talking with Dr. Roy Cordato of the John Locke Foundation. And Dr. Cordato, you say that your foundation has come up with a consumption-based tax system. Tell us about that.
Well, our plan is, we call it the USA tax, unlimited savings account tax. What we would do is, first of all, abolish the sales tax, and the two big cornerstones are abolish the sales tax and transform the income tax into a what's called a consumed income tax. Namely, what we would do is treat all savings like IRAs currently treat savings. In other words, any amount of money that goes into savings or investment is deducted from the tax base, and what is used for consumption is taxed. And under our plan, it would be at a rate of 8.5%, which would is in the revenue neutral rate. And remember, that is with eliminating the sales tax. So that is 4.75% that people are not paying on purchases. Along with that, we propose to abolish the corporate income tax and the estate tax.
So how can you give us a real-world example of how that might work? Take us through the scenario.
Well, we start with a federal adjusted gross income off of your federal tax form. And filers would first take a personal exemption of 40% of their federal personal exemption. They would then deduct charitable contributions, which are not also not in the tax base. And then they would deduct net savings, which is essentially total savings minus anything that's withdrawn from savings to use for consumption, and pay taxes on what's left. So.
And pay that.
Generally speaking, that's how the plan would work.
And pay that 8.5% rate on what's left.
That's exactly right.
Alan Fryer of the North Carolina Budget and Tax Center. How different is that proposal from your plan?
Rachel, I would say it's night and day. First, I would say that I think the Locke Foundation proposal should be applauded for coming up with a creative approach to tax reform. I remember 10 years ago when these ideas were being kicked around in D.C. at the national level that were similar to this. Some of them were discarded as not being feasible. I think we have some similar concerns about that proposal here. I think the big one is just compliance and complexity. I know, you know, one of the big goals that we all agree on is making sure that the tax code is more transparent, more understandable. I think that there would be significant challenges in terms of managing compliance, particularly at the local level, and making this work. So there's a complexity challenge here. I think in response, our plan is relatively straightforward. It does keep a lot of the current tax structure intact. We address the sales tax. In particular, we try to expand the base of the sales tax to include those services that are not currently taxed. We only tax mostly goods that are actually produced. So we would expand the base of the sales tax to cover services and use the savings we get from that in order to actually reduce the sales tax to make sure that folks are paying less at the point of sale than they are now. At the same time, I think we agree with the Locke Foundation in terms of reducing the complexity of the corporate code. in particular. We close a lot of these loopholes and deductions that favor one industry over another, try to get rid of all those, and again, use that to lower the corporate tax rate to improve efficiency, which is, I know, one of the goals that the Locke Foundation proposal seeks after. And lastly, we do make some progressive changes to the personal income tax. I think that the proposal adds an additional new high-end bracket for extremely high-end users over $1 million, at the same time as expanding the earned income tax and lowering the lowest tax bracket, or the lowest rate in the lowest tax bracket, in order to make the plan revenue neutral.
And we'll talk about the earned income tax credit and what's happening with that at the legislative level in just a little while. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Coastline. We're talking about tax reform at the state level and what it could mean for us here on the coast. And Chris Coudray, New Hanover County Manager, what would the implications be for this area if we instituted a broader sales tax that included services currently not taxed? Would that disproportionately affect lower income workers, like waiters, for example? Or,
you know, excuse me, I don't know the answer to that question. You know, and there are concerns reasonable on both sides about expanding the sales tax base. But if that were to happen, I don't think there's anyone that would disagree that if we're going to broaden the base of sales tax, and I'm not suggesting that's right or wrong, but if we're going to broaden the base, we've got to ultimately lower the overall rate. You think about New Hanover County. We're one of a handful of counties in the state that has gone about instituting, voter approved, but an additional quarter cent sales tax in our community to help sustain the public services that we're providing. So our tax rate today, sales tax rate, is 7%. The majority of counties in North Carolina are going to be 6.75%. So we're already paying a slightly elevated rate. And I think there's at some point with the sales tax model, if it's the only model used, there's likely a rate that it becomes uncompetitive and unsustainable. Where that is, I don't know the answer.
We haven't pushed the limits on that yet.
You know, I don't think we have, but I think that's something that as a public administrator, you've got to be cognizant of, understanding how does sales tax affect business decisions? Does it become too costly to do business in our community, as an example?
Chris, are you hearing from people about that? Do you hear from, say, small businesses who talk to you about the sales tax rate here?
I do not hear that the rate is too high. I don't hear consumers of goods express concern about the sales tax rate, and I'm not hearing that from the business community either. And I point to the reality that our voters, more than 51% in 2010, voted to add that tax to themselves because they saw the value in the services provided by New Hanover County. But irrespective, if we're going to broaden the base of services, there's got to be a serious conversation about lowering the overall rate to make it affordable and to make sure that we're competitive.
343-1138 is the number to call if you have a comment, a question, or a concern about tax reform at the state level and how it could affect us. You can also send an email to talk@whqr.org or tweet us at #HQRTalk. Dr. Roy Cordato of the John Locke Foundation, you've called the current system of personal income tax and particularly corporate income tax a double and triple tax. You've also called the corporate income tax a dishonest tax. Can you explain why you say that?
Yeah, well, it's a dishonest tax because it clearly is the least transparent tax we have. Corporations do not, in fact, cannot pay taxes. All taxes have to come out of somebody else's pocket, a real person's pocket. Corporation is a legal entity. Corporate income taxes come from lower wages, come from higher prices, or reduced dividends. Those are the possibilities. If you're for higher corporate income taxes, you are essentially saying you think workers are being paid too much, that consumers are paying too much, and that shareholders are receiving too much. That consumers aren't paying enough, and shareholders are receiving dividends that are too high. That's essentially what you're saying. It is a hidden tax from all of those groups, which also makes it very easy to demagogue. People can say, oh, corporations aren't paying their fair share, Well, in fact, corporations, as I said, can't pay tax. That's why if you look at the literature on a corporate income tax in economics, there's lots of discussion about who pays the corporate income tax. But one thing you never see is that corporations pay the income tax, because anyone who is familiar with tax analysis knows that corporations, as a legal entity, can't pay taxes. So this is why one of the main reasons, maybe the main reason why we think it should go, because it hides taxes from the people who pay them and therefore obfuscates the cost of government.
Alan Fryer of the North Carolina Tax and Budget Center, do you agree with that?
Well, we obviously have a different perspective on the corporate income tax. The state raises about $5 billion from taxes levied on corporate profits, whatever form that takes. I think one of the core assumptions here that I think Roy and I will definitely disagree over is the extent to which we know corporations would take, say, a cut or elimination of the corporate income tax and then pass that along to the folks that he mentioned. We have no guarantee at all that corporations will take the savings they get from eliminating the corporate income tax and pass that along to higher wages or to increased dividends. Actually, they probably will pass along increased dividends, but there is no guarantee that it will be passed along in terms of investment in capital plant infrastructure or job creation. And that ultimately is the point of what we all want to accomplish, or one of the points we want to accomplish with tax reform, is making it more competitive and conducive to economic growth. So that is a difference I know we have on the corporate income tax.
And can I jump in here?
Sure, absolutely. Dr. Cordato, from the—
talk about the corporations passing along, this is the point. They don't exist in a sense that they can pass it along. All taxes have to come out of somebody's pocket. Now, how a tax cut, who will pay less because of a tax cut in corporate taxes or elimination of corporate taxes is not clear, because it's not clear how the burden is distributed. We just know it is distributed among those groups. We're not talking about corporations passing a tax along. They can't, as a legal entity, can't pay a tax. And I'm surprised that Mr. Fryer doesn't understand this. It's one of the most basic principles of public finance. We know that people will get greater dividends. Sure, retired people living off of 401ks will get greater dividends. State workers whose pensions are heavily invested in stock, corporate stock, will get greater dividends. That is not such a bad thing, but I can't say how it will be distributed, and I don't know how he will. And it's frankly the literature that says that it will go mostly to corporate dividends. I don't know where it is, that it's there.
Let's take a phone call. We have Paul from Wilmington on the line. Welcome to Coastline, Paul.
Hi.
Hi.
I would like to ask the John Locke gentleman why the tax proposal he has discriminates against consumption of physical goods and services and not against consumption of stock dividends, insurance policies, anything that a wealthy person buys that the very poor do not necessarily buy. If I go to Sears and buy a hammer, I would pay a sales tax on that. If I go to a brokerage and buy stock in Sears, I would not pay sales tax on that transaction. Why do they not recognize that the hammer builds an economy just as much as the stock certificate does?
Dr. Cordato?
Well, first of all, our proposal eliminates the sales tax. So the sales tax doesn't really apply here, but let me say that what our plan does is treat consumption and investment equally. There's very simple arithmetics you can go through, but when you tax a dollar, it reduces consumption by 10%. It also reduces the return to investment by 10%. When you tax the return to investment, whether it's dividends or on a stock or whatever, it taxes it again. So the effective penalty on the investment would be 20% if it was a 10% tax. So the point is that we don't favor consumption, or I'm sorry, investment over consumption. What the tax does is treat the two equally. It's a neutral tax in that sense. And by the way, people don't consume stocks. They use the returns from stocks and other kinds of investments for consumption purposes. But you don't eat stocks. You don't take vacations on stocks. You don't do any of that.
Great. Thanks for the call, Paul. Coming up on the final segment of Coastline, we'll take a look at incentives, whether they contribute to economic growth, and we'll have a search for common ground. The phone lines are open. Do you think you know how state legislators should approach tax reform? If you have ideas, concerns, comments, give us a call at 343-1138 or send an email to talk@whqr.org, or you can tweet us at #HQRTalk. You're listening to Coastline. Welcome back to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn, and I'm joined in the studios today by New Hanover County Manager Chris Coudray. Also with us today, Alan Fryer, a public policy analyst at the North Carolina Budget and Tax Center. And joining us by phone is Dr. Roy Cordato, Vice President of Research and a resident scholar at the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back, gentlemen. Good to have you here. We're talking today about tax reform at the state level. In a moment, we're going to explore the idea of business incentives. I just want to address an email. Lee from Wilmington writes, "Don't consumption taxes tend to reduce consumption?" Dr. Cordato, what would you say to that?
No. We already have a consumption tax. Consumption already is taxed, both through the income tax system and the sales tax system. So right now, if let's say you're paying 6% state income tax, well, that's 6% on all your consumption purchases because consumption is already made with after-tax dollars. Then you turn around, you pay a 4.5% state. I'm not including the local sales tax. 4.5% state sales tax on top of it, right? So you're that person who is paying at the 6% tax bracket is paying about 10.5% on consumption already. Under our plan, they would be paying 8.5%. So they would be paying actually less on consumption than they currently are in terms of percentage. Now the advantage of ours is like the Justice Center's proposal through they want to use the current sales tax to do it, but it doesn't discriminate between different kinds of consumption purchases. So, for example, it doesn't matter whether you spend the money on a service like a haircut or buy a new stereo with it or, by the way, buy something over the Internet through Amazon. And it eliminates the entire Amazon tax problem of how do you tax purchases from Internet purchases.
343-1138 is the number to call. You can send an email to talk@whqr.org or tweet us at #HQRTalk. Alan, we hear a great deal of talk, particularly as part of Governor McCrory's agenda, about how North Carolina needs to become more customer-friendly, open for business. The implication is that the state isn't really doing a great job of encouraging businesses to locate here. But you don't agree with that notion.
What I would say is I think it's a credit to Governor McCrory that he wants to make the state more competitive. I think he spent a lot of time talking about that last fall, and he certainly spent a lot of time talking about it now. His two sort of core approaches to doing that involve reforming the tax code, which we've been talking about, and then reforming education, the educational system, better aligning it to make sure that the educational system, K-12, community colleges, better aligned with each other and better aligned with the needs of businesses. And I think that that's definitely an approach that we share and we agree with. I think that the big concern that we have is that any approach to tax reform could well end up starving the state of the resources it needs in order to actually pursue upgrading the workforce, training the workforce, transforming the workforce in the way that the governor suggested. We do know from the folks who do firm location, site location decisions that North Carolina is actually considered to be pretty competitive already. Site Selection Magazine, which is hardly a left-wing publication. It's the magazine for professionals who help CEOs decide where to locate new plants. They've ranked North Carolina number one, the best place in the nation to do business, I think 9 out of the last 11 years. The 2 years we weren't number one, we were number two and number three, respectively. CEO Magazine, very similar rankings. Forbes Magazine, again, these are good, you know, pro-business publications. And they keep saying that North Carolina is one of the best and most competitive places to do business to begin with. So, and the reasons why they say this is that they say that North Carolina has great infrastructure and they have a solid workforce and, importantly, the educational system to train that workforce. So I am sensitive to the theoretical public finance literature that says that these are competitive, the current tax system is puts North Carolina at a competitive disadvantage for a number of different reasons. But we don't really seem to see that in terms of the site location decisions that are being made, or at least the reasons that the CEOs give. I guess the question is, do we take those CEOs at their word, or do we assume that they don't actually mean what they're saying? So I think that's a good start.
Well, I think that leads right into the question of business incentives. And Chris Coudray, New Hanover County Manager, the county recently agreed to contribute to the pot for incentives for a local company. Can you tell us about that, about the incentives for Castle Branch and why the county decided that was a good move?
Castle Branch specifically, a business that has a proven track record in our community, more than 10 years, the kinds of jobs that people talk about they want to see happen in our community, knowledge jobs, information technology jobs, jobs that any community would be proud to have. Our board made the right decision in recognizing a company that has invested here and has grown here is going to add 400 jobs to our community, is going to engage in building new infrastructure in the form of a building that could be upwards of $10 million, that it was appropriate to partner with the state, and the state offered incentives as well, to partner with the city of Wilmington and offer an incentive to Castle Branch to ensure that they made the decision when it comes time to expand. And whether we like it or not, there are other beautiful places in this country to live, and there was serious consideration about taking this expansion, 400 jobs, to the state of California. And our board made the decision that it was appropriate to invest in that. Every incentive package request has got to be evaluated on its own merits. And our board made the decision, and I recommended to them that they grant those incentives. It was the right thing to do with the information that was presented and the opportunity that was before us.
Dr. Roy Cordato, how does the John Locke Foundation view incentives, business incentive packages?
Targeted business incentive packages we have been against always. I mean, we again, it's part of this view that the tax system, especially, should not pick winners and losers. It should not favor some kinds of investments over others.
But what if it
on
works?
On the other hand, let me point out, that with analysis of our tax policy, we just heard numbers 400 jobs created. Analysis of our tax plan done by the Suffolk University's Beacon Hill Institute estimates that in the first year our plan would create 80,000 jobs for North Carolina. And over a 5-year period, it would jack that up to about 89,000. So this would be a great incentive for job creation. To adopt the kind of plan that we're advocating.
Alan, Alan Fryer of the North Carolina Justice Center. Do incentives compel businesses, in your opinion, to locate or expand in a state?
I think the Justice Center over the years has agreed with the John Locke Foundation on this particular issue, although there is some new research that is showing that in certain cases, some targeted incentives to the right type of firms and the right type of industries can, in fact, increase job growth and wage growth. Although, I mean, that needs to be caveated with a lot. The research does exist, but it is those findings need to be reaffirmed elsewhere. I think that the concerns that that Dr. Cordato expressed on this are highly relevant for this discussion.
And that leads us into film incentives, because that's a particular area. We know that state leaders from the coast are working hard in Raleigh now to convince their colleagues in Raleigh that film incentives are different from traditional business incentive packages. Chris, can you talk about that a little bit?
Look at the track record in the last 24 months, just in our community, and then consider the statewide impact. Film incentives are working. We had a $200 million film industry last year. We had record numbers of productions, and the film industry is ultimately a very nimble industry. It doesn't take a lot of infrastructure to create a film environment. It's a very portable, nimble business. And if we were not making film a priority, and apparently the evidence suggests that incentives are the best way to do that, if we weren't making that a priority in North Carolina, it is highly likely that our film industry would leave. And I think that's why you see leadership on both sides of the General Assembly advocating for and promoting the value of targeted strategic incentives, and film is one of those.
And this is one of the interesting things that we've heard from state leaders who generally are not fans of incentives. They say, we can't deny the fact that film incentives work. And they often point to Michigan, which is a state that has seen tremendous drop off in film production activity since they cut their incentives drastically. Dr. Cordato, Alan Fryer, how do you respond to that? This is practical reality. We want to bring these production companies to the area. This is what makes them come. How can you argue with that?
Let me just point out, you always see the jobs created with the incentives. Okay? You never see the jobs that are lost because wealth and income is being transferred from other parts of the economy, the state's economy, to do that. So, look, if you spend a lot of money on some, or you give a lot of incentives to somebody, and they will respond to them. What you're not seeing is what's lost. It's a classic case of ignoring what economists call opportunity costs. Opportunity costs are things that aren't seen. They're the things that don't happen because something else does happen. And so, yes, you can always say, gee, we gave this industry money and they came here. We have a film industry in the state because of the incentives. But what you don't see is what's not happening because of wealth transfers from one group to another. And so to point to the benefits only and to ignore the economic reality that there are opportunity costs to these, it does not do the analysis justice at all.
Alan Fryer of the North Carolina Justice Center.
I think the point about opportunity cost is important. We recognize that incentives come from state scarce dollars, scarcer every year, and could be scarcer yet next year. So you want to get as big a bang as buck as possible. The research, I can't speak to the film incentive in particular in the case of Wilmington. But what I can do is talk about the research that we've done that shows that when incentives have been targeted to those industries that have been supported by very specific biotechnology sector, life science sector, biomanufacturing sector, workforce training, and strategic planning initiatives that are typically run by public-private partnerships between the state, private entities, and community colleges, we actually see significant overperformance from local firms in those industries compared to those that did not receive the incentive. So for us, it speaks to the importance of public investments that actually can get a pretty good bang for the buck in terms of promoting economic growth.
And let's take another phone call. It looks like we have a caller. Hello, caller. Welcome to Coastline. And the caller is not there. Okay, we do have a few minutes left. If you would like to make a comment, ask a question, express a concern about how tax reform in the state, including incentive packages, could affect you, give us a call at 343-1138. You can also send us an email to talk@whqr.org or tweet us at #HQRTalk. And Alan Fryer of the North Carolina Justice Center wanted to revisit the earned income tax credit. First of all, can you explain what that is very simply and where it is now in terms of the General Assembly?
So we'll start with the federal earned income tax credit was created in the early 80s by President Reagan as an anti-poverty tool to reward work. It basically provides a refundable tax credit to work low-income families who don't make enough money to pay federal income tax, but they're working, so they pay the payroll taxes that support Social Security and Medicare. So the EITC was intended to cover those taxes that they wouldn't otherwise get offset. The state earned income tax credit was passed in 2008, I believe, and was intended to increase the benefit that a state worker could get from the federal EITC. And so it's been last year, the earned income tax credit, along with every other tax credit in loophole and deduction, was extended for 1 year. Originally, it was set to sunset last year, but they extended it for 1 year so that it could be discussed as part of this big overall comprehensive tax reform plan. But what we're seeing is that it's not being handled as part of the overall comprehensive tax reform plan. Instead, what we're seeing is that it's being handled on a piecemeal basis. Over the last 3 weeks, both the House and the Senate have passed, the General Assembly, the House and the Senate have passed measures that both cut the earned income tax credit benefit for this year, for 2013, and then allowed it to sunset at the end of this tax year. And so obviously we have a problem with that. We believe the earned income tax credit is important in promoting work. It's important in providing sufficient resources so that families, particularly those earning low-wage jobs, are able to feed their family. So we think there's an important moral perspective on this. And we do think it's good economics that providing additional consumption assistance to low-income families can help overall consumption of local businesses, which is obviously good for the overall economy.
And let's take a call. We have Jim from Wilmington on the line. Jim, welcome to Coastline. Jim, are you there? Okay. He's not there. Hello, caller, you're on the air. And we don't have him. Hello, Jim from Wilmington, you're on the air.
Yes, real quick, and I'll take the answer off there. Question along the lines of, and I know they talked about with military, of expanding the railroad from Amtrak on down to transportation and bringing in the military, as well as if we're growing the area with drawing new business in with the tax reform, what kind of impact studies have they done with respect to maybe enhancing on the railroad side as they bring in business and it'll bring in families coming in, moving in the area? They stay in hotels and eat in the restaurants. And I'll take the answer off there, but I didn't know if they've looked at anything along lines with the railroad. Thank you.
Jim, are you talking about the railroad? That there's currently a bill to establish funding for a railroad that has been defunct for a number of years, many years. Is that the railroad line that you're talking about?
I think maybe 2 weeks ago on NPR, they talked about the Fort Bragg and Camp Lejeune both were looking into getting the heavier vehicles off of the highway, and they were looking at having the railroad expanded from the Fayetteville area, like Raleigh, as well as Jacksonville in, and it just made me think that we could have a huge advantage with enhancing all the way through Amtrak into the area.
Okay. Chris Coudray of New Hanover County.
I do know there's interest in a bill out there to support funding, as you said, to reestablish the line from Wilmington to Weldon. At the end of the day, it's going to take a strong business case to make that argument. Passenger rail is part of that. Freight and cargo is important to that argument as well. So we'll see where it goes.
Thank you. And that wraps up this edition of Coastline. Our guests today on the show have been Alan Fryer, public policy analyst at the North Carolina Justice Center, Chris Coudray, New Hanover County Manager, and Dr. Roy Cordato, Vice President of Research at the John Locke Foundation. Thanks to all of you for joining us today. Join us next week for Coastline when we hold our first reporters roundtable. Coastline is produced by Asia Brown and Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Cleve Callison is the executive producer. Lindsay McGrath is our call screener. Asia Brown is our board operator. Dorothy Rankin is our technical coordinator. And John Mortara is our webmaster. Heartfelt thanks to all of you who called, emailed, and tweeted us today. We're always glad to have you join the conversation here on Coastline. The views and opinions expressed on this program are those of our listeners and our guests, and not necessarily of WHQR Public Radio.